Chronic wasting disease has been found in Eau Claire County at a deer farm in the village of Fairchild. And now the DNR tells us two bucks from that farm are on the loose and possibly infected with the disease. Also, big changes are in store for counties and their shoreland zoning ordinances thanks to a surprise motion slipped into the budget in the last moments of the process. We'll talk about those issues with the Outdoor Guys and special guests this hour on the West Side Outside. I'm Rich Kramer, and I'd like to welcome the Outdoor Guys back to the program. They are, in no particular order, Joe Knight. He is the outdoor editor for the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram. Joe, thanks for stopping by.
Pleased to be here.
And also we've got Dave Carlson. He is the creator and star of the TV show Northland Adventures. He's also an outdoor writer in his free time. Dave Carlson, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
Absolutely. And on the phone, we've got two very special guests as well. First, I'll introduce George Meyer. He is a former DNR secretary and currently the executive director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. George Meyer, thanks for being part of the program.
Good morning, Rich. Thank you.
Good morning. And Dave Clausen joins us by phone as well. He is a retired veterinarian and former Natural Resources Board member. Dave Clausen, thanks so much.
Morning, Rich. Pleasure.
Morning. Listeners, we would like to hear from you as well. The number to call in is 1-800-228-5615. We've got wide open phone lines. We're going to spend the first half hour or so of the program talking about CWD in general and also the specifics of the case that was found in Eau Claire County. And we'll talk about those bucks that are on the loose that the DNR is urging people to help them find. Then after the half hour or so, we will talk about shoreland zoning. Motion in the state budget has changed how counties can zone their shorelines. The number to call in, 1-800-228-5615. Joe Knight, since you've been covering this pretty well as far as the CWD locally, what happened at the deer farm in Eau Claire County?
Well, we had a positive detect of chronic wasting disease. It was in early June, and they did the gold standard test, sent it off to the federal lab in Iowa, and that confirmed that it was, in fact, chronic wasting, and we got the news about the middle of June. And the owner did talk to me at the time, and he said he's been, that the doe, it was a seven-year-old doe, that it was born in the pen and had not left it, that he's been raising deer in that pen for something like 16 years in that farm, and has had to test every one that died and has never had a positive detect before.
Mm-hmm.
So where we stand now, I think DADCAP is going to depopulate, is their word for it, basically kill all the deer and to test them. You have to kill the animal, basically, to get a brain sample to do the test for chronic wasting disease. So we're just kind of waiting to see what that test will be. In the meantime, there have been a couple breaks over the years from that deer pen. It's hard to keep deer down in the farm. You know, they're powerful animals. And once it was attributed to vandalism, and in May, a tree fell over and knocked down part of the fence, and about 20 bucks got out, of which two are at large. Mm-hmm. One was recently shot by a logger who got permission from the DNR. He said, "Hey, I see a deer."
With the yellow ear tip.
And also, the other thing going on is I've gotten calls from a couple people who I know who live near there and hunt near there, and they say, "Well, it's not that unusual to see a deer that obviously isn't one of the local deer, a deer with Boone and Crockett antlers and an ear tag strolling in front of their tail camera, their trail camera." Yeah, so
interesting.
They assume that deer may, you know, get out more often than we think.
All right. Previous escapes,
yeah. One fellow said he saw one in his front yard in April, and the escape didn't occur till mid-May, so.
Really? And about that, I'm just kind of wondering about the timeline of all this. Because it seems like we found out about the escape after we found out about the positive. So how did that work?
Well, it has been reported, but we just weren't following as closely. A deer escapes from a deer farm. We have, I forget how many in the state, over 400.
Yeah.
And so that's a concern. But then when you find a case of chronic wasting disease, then it becomes more of a concern, because the concern is he was exposed to the sick deer in the pen, perhaps.
Sure. I also have to let everyone know, the listeners and the guests, that I did reach out to, we invited members of the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, also known as DATCAP, also the Department of Natural Resources, or DNR, They both could not join the program. The DADCAP declined, and the DNR said that they're working on some messaging related to chronic wasting disease, and they kind of want to get their ducks in a row, I think, before they talk about it. So with that, we reached out to both agencies and were turned down. So, Dave Claussen, I want to ask you, how in the world could CWD get to a deer farm when this deer was born in the pen, and all the deer that have died there have tested negative for CWD? How does it happen?
Well, there's some people used to talk about spontaneous CWD, but there has not been a documented case of that. But you have to realize in this particular situation, while his breeder pen, which is about 12 acres, I think, if I understand right, and like 167 deer, I think I read that someplace, which is pretty crowded. But he also owns what I call a shooter operation, where people go in and shoot deer with large antlers. His breeder pen is part of the CWD program, certification program. His shooting operation is not. That's not in the herd status type of thing, and people have a choice whether they want to do that or not. And the difference is that by not being in the CWD certification program, he is only required to test 50% of the deer that are killed on that property, and because they're supposed to leave, they're dead. And if they go to slaughter, 25% of them have to be tested. So we know that CWD can be on soil, and actually, when it binds to soil, it's 700 times more infective, and biosecurity departments of ag like to talk about that a lot, but we only have to go back to the bird flu thing here to see that biosecurity is often not what it is kind of trumped up to be or talked up to be. And in a situation like this, it's entirely possible. We also know that CWD can transfer in dust. It can wash off a property in water. But it's not implausible to think that a vehicle could have driven out of one of those farms and driven into another one. It could have come on boots. And it does not take very much. I think Chris Johnson at the National Wildlife Health Center, I believe it was him that early on was talking about that there is enough infectious material in the brain of one deer that dies from CWD. There is enough infectious material in there that if it were diluted out, it could infect every whitetail in North America. So we're not talking massive quantities of stuff to bring infection. So, you know, whether that happened or not, I don't know, but it's certainly a plausible explanation.
Buckhorn Flats, that had an outbreak of CWD and a depopulation, as Joe put it, when the animals were removed, and then it was to become an outdoor lab. Is that the case? If so, are we learning anything over there?
Can you spell budget?
B-U-D-D-D-D-D, done.
Yeah, there you go.
Maybe we should give a little background on Buckhorn Flats.
Yeah, that was one of the original cases, wasn't it?
Right.
It was a deer farm in Portage County, and it was a little unique because it was tied up in litigation, so the deer in that farm could not be killed. And when they finally did kill them all and test them, I think something like 80% were positive for chronic wasting disease.
Right. Then the state bought the property and began at least securing it and said that it was going to become a lab.
Well, I kind of want to talk about just generally because it's fascinating to me, and maybe some of our listeners, you know, they've heard the term CWD or chronic wasting disease, but what are we talking about? We're talking about mutated proteins, aren't we, called Dave Claussen?
Yeah, it's an abnormal prion, and it doesn't have any RNA and DNA, which is normally in the genetic makeup of anything, but yet it finds a way to reproduce by corrupting other proteins and causing them to become abnormal.
And it cannot be, how do you get rid of it?
It's really tough. It's not killed by common sterilization methods. In fact, there have been some concern here the last few years that with another prion disease, Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, actually contaminating surgical material and putting people that were subsequently, I mean, this went through, it adheres to stainless steel, among one of the other things, and common autoclaving procedures don't kill it. It's really tough, and it will persist in the soil. Scrapie has been shown to persist in the soil for up to 17 years.
The infection rate is increasing, too, is it not?
Yeah. There's some new work out showing that it actually can infect plants. Plants can pick it up out of the soil, and those plants are then infective to anything else that any susceptible species that may eat it. And that may be one of the reasons why this, as we get more and more environmental contamination, that may be one of the reasons why the infection rate climbs exponentially.
George or Dave, either one, don't special regulations kick in now around in Eau Claire County, Clark County, Jackson, so forth?
Yes. In those three counties, there will be a ban on the baiting and feeding of deer. So deer hunters wouldn't be able to put out bait to attract animals in. In addition, people will not be able to feed deer in those areas. So it is to minimize the opportunity for deer that have CWD to pass it on to other animals. The concern is that and I think you all have reported on this, is that animals have gotten out of this facility previously. We know that. And besides in situations Joe talked about, I've had reports from hunters in the area that, what happened periodically over time is that deer with yellow tags have been, on their ears, have been spotted in the area. So the concern is that CWD may have already been introduced into the wild deer herd surrounding the facility.
But Joe Knight, didn't you, one of your stories had looked up some stats on numbers of deer that were tested in the area, right?
They've done testing. We can talk about this with Doc Clausen a little bit, but they've done fairly extensive testing in the area and statewide, although perhaps, according to some folks like Clausen, not intensive enough to pick up a very low level of infection. But going back to one thing that Doc Clausen said about they now find that it can be CWD, the prion can be taken up into plant material. Although as of yet, I don't think there's any documentation that it can be spread to animals that way.
That's not exactly true. Experimentally, when they fed these plants that were grown in CWD positive or contaminated soil, they very easily infected the line of mice, the cervidized mice that they were using. And has it happened exactly to deer yet? No. But the best model we have is those mice, and that's been a fairly reliable thing. And they do get sick from it.
In the case of the one CWD deer being documented up at near Shell Lake a couple of years ago, that touched off, of course, a bunch of additional testing, and no, as far as I'm aware, no additional CWD positive deer have shown up. But the baiting and feeding ban remains in place, and I'm told that, and it's been reported too, that the enforcement of that regulation has been lax, to put it mildly.
So can I address the testing up in that area?
Please do, Dave Clausen.
They found that one single deer, and if you go back in history in Richland County, they found a single deer in 2002. They did not find another one for three more years, and in the meantime, they tested over 2,600 deer, which is more than double what they've tested in the Shell Lake area. And then they went another 4 years before they found another one down there. So the testing effort last year, if CWD is present in that Shell Lake area, number one, we don't know if that deer was in the center of where CWD might be or on the very edge of it. But if CWD was present at 0.5%, that would be the equivalent to taking 199 white marbles and one red marble, throwing them in a jar, and last year DNR reached in and pulled out 5 marbles. I'm not much of a poker player, but I wouldn't play with somebody with those kind of odds.
A reminder, we're talking about CWD being found at a deer farm in Eau Claire County, and now that we've heard that there are a couple of bucks from that farm that are on the loose, that they're not sure if they are contaminated, but the DNR wants to find them, deer with yellow ear tags. If you've got a comment or a question, give us a call, 800-228-5615. We can get you on the air. We've got a lot of knowledgeable folks on here that can answer your questions about chronic wasting disease. Are you worried about this disease, or have you heard so much about it that maybe you've kind of lost any kind of concern that you once had about it? 800-228-5615. That's Dave Carlson.
Yeah, George, I've got a question. As a former DNR secretary, how would you rate DNR's handling of the situation, not from the get-go, but currently dealing with the things that they are dealing with and maybe could be dealing with?
Well, currently, and I think Dave would share this opinion, is currently there's really not much being done. They have adopted what they call a passive approach, and that seems to even be an overstatement of what's being done. There is testing done in some of the areas where there has previously been reported CWD, especially in the core area in Iowa County, that area, and around some of the fringe areas. And that amounts basically what's being done, except in the situation where, let's take, Dave mentioned the Shell Lake situation, where you have what they call a spark. A deer was found with CWD in the wild, and then there was additional testing done. And they'll do that. They'll do additional testing in an area where they've already found CWD. You know, as my dad said, it's too late to close the barn door, then it's already out. So there's no activity being taken to slow the spread of the disease. And as was mentioned earlier on the show, it's increasing substantially in the core area where it started. I believe, and Dave, correct me if I'm wrong, it's up to 50% in the exact location where it was first found, in bucks in that area. So this is a disease that is spreading. It will affect the deer herd, and that's what's occurred out west. And while it is, you know, we have to be very careful, it's never, to our knowledge, crossed the threshold in humans. You know, that is not a totally impossible situation, and the state and federal health agencies have been very clear about that.
Dave Klassen, would you like to add anything to that?
Well, I would. I think that probably the incidence in that core area, to my knowledge, is probably a little closer to 35% than 50, but it won't be long if it continues on the path before it gets there.
Okay.
Since George Meyer brought up the aspect of threats to humans from eating this, I know in the media we have about a 5-minute attention span, and when CWD was first discovered back in 2002, everyone was afraid, oh, we're not going to eat venison anymore. Now we do eat venison even down in Iowa County. I think we have a natural experiment going on, and so far they have not found any crossover into people, although it's very slow developing. But Dave Clausen, do you want to talk about the humanized mice? And we can really scare people with some of the tests going on?
No, I don't want to. I do not want to really scare people, because what I would say is that the chances of CWD transmitted to humans have always been extremely small, but they've never ever been zero. And there's some recent work that came out that certainly reinforces that thing. It's not a foregone conclusion that people are going to get it, but it again demonstrates that it is possible. If you look at when the mad cow outbreak occurred in England, the government denied and denied and denied until they couldn't hide the bodies anymore. But the science of that is that there were probably 5,000 infected cattle carcasses consumed for every case of human Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, that developed. So it's really a very, very small thing. However, I did some work a year ago testing or checking out the percentage of deer that were positive in each of nine counties in the original CWD area, and then I multiplied that by the total number of deer killed, and it gives a graph of possible infected carcasses, and a statistician could argue with those numbers, but when you look at the graph, you can't argue with the fact that there are an increasing number of CWD infected carcasses being consumed. And that in itself is alarming to me.
Dave, as a former Natural Resources Board member, are you privy to any information about what the DNR's new CWD messaging might include? And maybe what would you add to it?
For the first time when you go on, first time to my knowledge, and I've looked fairly often, but for the first time to my knowledge, when it talks about processing your deer and stuff, it sends you right to the Department of Public Health, or the DHS, and their message has always been the same, and I'll see if I can quote it here, that the Wisconsin Department of Public Health recommends that people harvesting deer in the CWD management zone not consume or distribute that meat to others until the source animal comes back with a negative CWD test. That is a switch from what DNR used to say, where they would say, I'm going from memory because I can't find it online anymore, but I think they used to say something like, because people in England got sick from eating BSE cows, the Department of Public Health recommends that people not consume this venison. And then the next sentence is, there is no knowledge that anyone has ever contracted CWD from eating infected venison. So this is a thing from kind of an iffy type of thing. They're flat out saying don't eat it till it's tested. How that plays out when people need to get their deer tested is going to be an interesting issue.
And I want to talk about the whole change in the culture, or the how people think about CWD, and maybe this is for Dave or George, but people don't seem to be afraid of it anymore. And why is that? And is there some, should the DNR do more to keep it on people's, you know, top of mind?
Well, you know, this is George. See, it has been in Wisconsin for several years. No one has gotten sick by it. Mm-hmm. And there was a pushback against the initial regulations that were put in place, and people got tired about it. They have a short memory span, and you know, most of the state is outside the CWD area, so it's not a something that they even have to think about. Although they should be the ones most concerned about the fact that there's not an effort to slow the spread of this across the state, because ultimately that is the history of this disease out west, and clearly in the state of Wisconsin. You know, I think in the last about 3 or 4 years, about 7 or 8 new counties have been added to the CWD area in this state. So it's, unless something is immediate, it's hard for the public to stay engaged in these days, it seems, and whether it's this or some other long-term problem, it tends to get put by the wayside in their mind.
Given the density that seems to be the case at Deer Farms and these shooting operations that Dave alluded to, Dave Clausen. Should we reopen that debate about whether or not to ban deer farms and shooting operations in the state of Wisconsin?
Well, this is George. The one thing I think we need to do, and, you know, I, from a practical standpoint, the politics of banning 400 or 500, maybe a moratorium on any new ones would be a great idea. But candidly, and we're asking DNR and DADCAP to come forward the records, it's our belief and reports from inside the agencies, we need to enforce regulations there are in terms of inspections of these facilities, both by DNR on the fences and by the Department of Agriculture on the operations themselves. I think the first step would be to enforce the current regulations and then maybe look at a moratorium of any future operation.
With that, I want to kind of point out there's a group called Whitetails of Wisconsin. It's basically the members of this group are owners of deer farms, and it's kind of like the deer farm lobby, if you will. But in the Eau Claire Leader Telegram today, there was a editorial that someone had written basically saying that it's good that the DNR is stepping up its testing of chronic wasting disease, but they're basically, their point is that they have to test every single deer very extensively, according to them, but yet the DNR is only testing like, you know, 0.1% of the entire deer herd. Gentlemen, Dave Clausen or George Meyer, any thoughts to this? I think the basic message is don't beat up on deer farms.
Well, and I guess I would say that the vast majority of people that are involved in this business are good, honest individuals. But there's always a few that stretch the rules and some that outright break them. I mean, you can go and look at how many Lacey Act for illegal transporting a deer have. You don't have to look far to find some of those. And with what's at risk here, it doesn't take very many bad actors. And I can give an example that in Canada in the 1990s, they really wanted to get into deer farming. Government was pushing it and that type of thing. And as it turned out, there were tuberculosis-positive deer, in spite of being tested twice, that came from Colorado and I think Wyoming, and also two international, some red deer that came internationally. They had all been tested twice for tuberculosis and tested negative. And in addition, they were tested again as part of their program. They had very intensive government program to keep a close watch on that. But the end result was that those deer, in spite of testing negative, were positive because the TB test was not particularly accurate in those species at that time. And it ended up getting out. It ended up in four provinces. It infected cattle, deer, bison, hogs, and 42 people ended up undergoing treatment for tuberculosis that basically came from those deer farms. And the result was tens of millions of dollars worth of costs on this just for the subsidies or the indemnification. Plus, it cost Canada their TB-free status, and their ag department estimated that cost them over $1 billion. So, You know, when something goes wrong, it can really go wrong.
Sure.
Getting back to the question of what we should do now, what should we do now? I know Doc Clausen and I have talked about what Illinois has done. They've treated it more aggressively, tried to contain CWD more aggressively with sharpshooters, et cetera, as the DNR did in the early stages. But in Wisconsin, it seemed like there was never any political will to pursue that after it became so unpopular. And in fact, we've actually loosened up our deer regulations. We've taken away some of the unpopular tools that DNR used to use to manage the deer herd. So where do we go from here? Is there still time to be sending sharpshooters around half of the state that now has CWD or has at least bans on baiting and feeding? You're on
George?
George. Well, you know, let me take, you know, that is the problem with allowing this disease to spread unchecked. And basically that's DNR's policy now. Because every time you do that, you spread the geographical area. If you ever decide to put some controls in place, or if you have to do testing, individual hunters have to do testing, which is going to add to their cost of hunting. That just expands the area. So you do need to have a strategy whereby you try to break the cycle and reduce the deer populations in those areas, especially in the springe areas around the CWD infested area. Is it too late? Well, I tell you, if you're in Adams County or Juneau County, just north of the CWD area, this is the time it's got to get done, or your county's going to be next.
Well, what do you think of the new structure where you've got counties, county deer advisory councils? They're looking to increase the herd size down there. I mean, again, I think it goes back to what we were talking about a little earlier, that it seems like people just don't care anymore.
Well, and you raised a good point. That was really frustrating. One of the counties, I think it was Racine County down in southeastern Wisconsin, which has CWD in it, the local council, the hunters' representatives and the other representatives on that group actually in that area voted to expand the deer herd. Now, I can see hunters doing that and wanting to have greater opportunity. What was unbelievable is that recommendation was supported by the Department of Natural Resources and approved by the Natural Resources Board, who has responsibility to protect the deer herd. And what they did is probably increase the chance for CWD to spread in that area. It was just shocking that the agency made that decision.
So I think Secretary Stepp actually commented publicly on the wisdom of that, but if you're being kinder and gentler, it's pretty hard to tell anybody no.
Well, with that, any final questions, gentlemen? It's time for us to take our break here. Actually, way past time for me to take the first break, but with that, I want to thank you both so much. George Meyer is the former DNR Secretary. He's currently the Executive Director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. George Meyer, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And yeah, Dave Clausen, thanks to you, retired veterinarian and former Natural Resources Board member. Thanks for the insight, Dave.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And with that, we're going to take our first break. Still joining us are the outdoor guys, Joe Knight and Dave Carlson. And after the break, we'll hear from Mike Engelson, who's the Executive Director of Wisconsin Lakes. And we're going to talk about shoreland zoning and whatever else we can fit in the rest of the hour. This is the West Side Outside.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association. Support also comes from Marshfield Clinic, a Medicare and Medicaid services accountable care organization committed to improving quality of care and patient experience. More information at marshfieldclinic.org/ACO.
I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to The West Side Outside. I'm joined today by Joe Knight. He's the outdoor editor for the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram, and Dave Carlson is an outdoor writer and creator of the syndicated hit TV show Northland Adventures. We're talking about, we just finished up a segment talking about CWD being found in Eau Claire County. Next, we're going to talk about some big changes for how counties can zone their parts of the property within their borders. And joining us for that discussion, shoreland zoning, is Mike Engelson. He's the executive director of Wisconsin Lakes. Mike Engelson, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure, thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. And listeners, we do have space for you to lend your thoughts and offer your suggestions and comments. The number is 800-228-5615. That number again, 800-228-5615. I do want to point out that I also sent invitations to State Representative Adam Jarko. He's a Republican from Balsam Lake, and he was one of the main forces behind these changes to shoreline zoning that we'll talk about in just a bit, but he was unavailable to join us for the discussion. Also, Tom Tiffany was a supporter. He's a state senator, Republican, and he couldn't join us either. So with that, Mike, what was the big change for shoreline zoning in counties?
Well, there were a number of changes that occurred as part of the budget process. It was a motion that was slipped into the budget at the sort of the last minute by the Joint Finance Committee. The biggest change is that it reversed a decades-long process, a process that's been in place since the shoreline zoning program was first passed back in the late 60s, that allows used to allow counties to pass shoreline zoning ordinances stronger than the minimum standards set by the state. So the law says that every county in the state has to have a shoreline zoning ordinance, that the state should set minimum standards for those ordinances, and it used to be that counties could go beyond those. The budget bill reversed that and really invalidated about 25 to 30, I'm not sure of the exact number, but a number of counties that have ordinances that already are stronger than the state minimums. So those counties are having to scramble now to deal with the fallout from that.
All right, and in general, what we're talking about is counties that decided to change how people deal with their shoreline, getting rid of things like structures too close to water, and adding more natural vegetation, stuff like that?
Correct. So in general, shoreline zoning deals with development within the shoreline zone, which is generally around within 1,000 feet of a lake or 300 feet of a river or stream. And the standards cover things like the minimum lot size, the setback, how far buildings have to be from the edge of the water, how much surface is what's called impervious. So impervious surface is a surface that doesn't allow water to sort of seep into the ground. So things like driveways and roofs and things like that, mm-hmm. And a number of other things.
All right. And real basically, before we get into, we've got a caller on the line now, but what are some of the dangers if there's too many of these impervious, or if there's too much development near a lake, what is the main danger?
Sure. Well, studies have shown pretty conclusively that the more development near a lake and the more runoff that results from that development, so as rain falls on top of roofs or on parking lots or other structures, or doesn't have a vegetative buffer to sort of slow the water down and let the stuff in that water, which when you have development can be contaminants, sort of seep down into the ground rather than going into the water, you have a lowering of the water quality of the lake.
Okay. With that, I want to take our first caller, and this is William. William, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Yes, thank you. And I am the chairman of the Polk County Board of Supervisors, and we were one of the counties that was very dramatically affected by this change in shoreline zoning. Polk County has been spending the last 4 years putting together our new, updating our comprehensive land use plan, and we obviously are a very tourist lake-driven economy up here, and we have 15 very strong protection and rehab districts around our lakes, and we take our water pretty seriously, and we were very disturbed, I guess, at how this process, not only how it came into place in that omnibus motion of joint finance, but how it was just shot through the legislature and ended up in the budget. And Polk County unanimously passed a resolution late last month opposing it, sent that to Representative Jarko and our 10th Senate District Representative Sheila Harsdorf. And obviously they both voted for it at least once, in Harsdorf's case twice, to keep it in the budget. And, you know, St. Croix County did the same thing. I believe Oneida County did. So there was a lot of opposition from the people that are directly involved with lakes in their districts. And one perspective being another loss of local control over things. But in that 4-year process of updating our comprehensive zoning, our comprehensive land use plan. You know, we have a lakes classification system. We have a lot of small lakes that are very affected by what you do around them. And again, we take this very seriously that this was included in the budget and took away that local control piece of being able to look after our own water up here. So that would be my comment on it, and
Please don't go away. I've got to ask, yep. What are you going to do about it? This is Dave Carlson. So yep. What is the county going to do about it now? What are some of the, for example, when you buy property on lakes, you're often through the county zoning office given a packet of materials which tells you what to do. So what do you give people now? What do you tell the people who want to maybe do some changes to their dwellings on these lake properties? What's Polk County going to do?
Well, after the effective date, about all we can do is update our information packets like that to reflect the new language that came out of the budget motion. I know in one instance, our setback on one of our classes of lakes was 100 feet instead of 75, like the Natural Resources Board does. So at this point, I guess our only option is to update it and go with what the state said. I mean, that's kind of the way the system works.
Should something be done legislatively?
Well, I've been asked by a couple of the supervisors on our board to set up a meeting with Representative Jericho and Senator Harsdorf to at least chat about why we were ignored in the legislative process with our intent and our opinion on this.
Now this is Joe Knight. You're in Jericho's district. He's your mm-hmm. he's your guy, isn't he?
Correct.
Yet the county board voted unanimously.
Correct.
I guess Jericho, in his real life job, he's an attorney, and I know he's had some frustrations. I've talked to him about this with shoreland zoning and some of his clients. But.
Right, and I think one of his main arguments is property rights. I mean, these people. They pay a lot for the right to own this land, and his argument is that you've got a patchwork of different counties doing different things. It's confusing. This is a certainty, as is mentioned.
But the situation is private land, public water.
Exactly.
And also, I think one of the problems that we had with that argument of certainty is that, first of all, this is about zoning. And zoning is different everywhere you go in the state. You know, the agricultural zoning is different in Milwaukee County than it is in the central part of the state, where you can do that kind of stuff and what the standards are within certain zones. So anytime you're doing building anywhere, you have to know what the local standards are, because they're not certain anywhere, and they probably shouldn't be.
We should have statewide standards for building anywhere.
Well, I'm certainly not promoting that, but that would be the logical implication of that argument, I think.
Yeah, which we know can't affect. It shouldn't. It's not a logical argument.
Well, and then in addition to that, I think it's most people that own waterfront property, and I should add, Wisconsin Lakes is an organization that is made up almost entirely of waterfront property owners. So we represent lake associations, lake districts, waterfront property owners, and lake users around the state. And most of our membership has owned their property for a long period of time. It's not like waterfront property owners move around a lot from county to county, bouncing from property to property, where they're going to have to learn a whole new set of rules to do their development. So that whole line of argument I found a bit specious.
All right, and real quickly, before we let William go, you're still there, right, William?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Legislatively, there may be options in the future, but what about the courts? Is there any possibility that the county or a group like Wisconsin Lakes challenge or file suit about this somehow?
Well, from the county perspective, not that I'm aware of at this point, but, you know, it might be kind of interesting to point out, too, also the Wisconsin Counties Association opposed this and spent a bit of time down in Madison in the last couple of weeks as the budget went through. And we're, of course, Polk County is a member of the Wisconsin Counties Association, and we have members on the steering committee for environmental use and those different things like that. So, you know, we just felt that it was a very disingenuous thing for Representative Jericho to do, to get that language through Tom Tiffany into the Joint Finance Committee, and it's something he's been working on. You know, during our whole process of public meetings on updating our comprehensive land use plan, he has in the past has represented property owners on lakeshore situations in opposition to zoning things too. So, you know, his private life as an attorney and things have kind of blended together. He made public comments various times during the process of how he was opposed to it, and, you know, magically when the county wasn't really going along with it, then all of a sudden it ends up on the legislature, on the floor of the legislature. So,
all right.
We should maybe note that Jarko is not on the Joint Finance Committee.
No, he is not.
He had a kindred spirit there.
Yeah, they have what are called budget buddies, actually, they work with members.
Well, what kind of peril does this present immediately for the waters of Polk County? And you're familiar, too, that there are other impaired waters in St. Croix and Dunn and Eau Claire and Chippewa counties.
You know, we were aware that a couple of our lakes have been added to the impaired waters list. You know, it's generally phosphorus and those sorts of things. But, you know, throughout our whole process, our committees were using basic science-based evidence of things that you can find out there, and a lot of research has been done about impervious surfaces and things built within certain distances of waters without any kind of buffer and all that kind of thing. So it wasn't like we were just shooting in the dark saying we want farther distance setbacks on things for no apparent reason. So,
All right. Well, William, we're going to let you go. We've got some other callers on the line. And Mike Engelson, hang tight. We're going to take a one-minute break. We'll be back to talk more about shoreland zoning and some big changes to shoreland zoning and how it's been approached that were introduced in the state budget. I'm Rich Kramer. This is the West Side Outside.
An 18-month investigation with Frontline, KQED, Univision, and IRP.
She was in tears. She had that help me look on her face.
Women raped and attacked on the night shift, cleaning our offices and our workspaces.
They allowed these women for years to be abused.
On the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Tonight at 6 on the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from Chocolatarian Cafe, offering desserts, wine, and light fare with a European patisserie ambiance. Located in a historic building on the east side of Madison. More at chocolatariancafe.com.
If you're shopping online, check out our website at wpr.org/shop to find out if your online purchases can benefit your favorite radio station. Remember, wpr.org/shop.
Also, if you're online and you want to check out past episodes of the West Side Outside, you can go to WPR.org, click on the Shows tab, and look for the West Side. You'll be able to find years' worth of programming there. This show will be uploaded shortly after we finish our broadcast. Right now, we're talking about shoreland zoning. I've got the outdoor guys, Joe Knight and Dave Carlson. Also, we're joined by Mike Engelson. He's the Executive Director of Wisconsin Lakes. 800-228-5615. It looks like the phone lines are filling up quickly. Let's talk very quickly, Mike Engelson, about how the law was changed. What about the process that they used, the Joint Finance Committee process, is different than the last time that lake or shoreland zoning issues were changed at the state level?
Sure. What the committee did is a process that has been used by both parties when they've been in control for decades and is objectionable, in my opinion, regardless of which party is in control, which is basically to insert non-budgetary, non-fiscal law changes into the budget without the opportunity for public comment. That's wrong on a policy level. And I think this change demonstrates another instance where it's problematic, because normally you would have a bill that would be introduced, it would go into a committee, there would be a public hearing, and people could point out problems with the bill. Sometimes those are problems of policy, sometimes those are problems related to process. In this case, there was no implementation period or strategy set up for the counties to deal with these changes. The changes are in place now, and you have a whole bunch of counties across the state that now have unenforceable ordinances that have to figure out what to do.
Mm-hmm.
That could have been pointed out at the committee level, And maybe that change, maybe some sort of fix would have happened before that bill was passed. Instead, it went through the budget, you know, a huge budget bill, and wasn't able to be really fully considered.
Right, a lot of other things to keep an eye on and to study. Right now, we're going to go to Willem in Colfax. Willem, you're on the air. I need you to be as brief as possible. We're getting close to the top of the hour. What's on your mind?
Well, I would agree that this is policy is not only unwise of slipping these things into the budget and not having public hearings on it. Not only is it unwise, I think it's undemocratic. I think it does really harm to the whole principle that the Republican Party likes to use in their rhetoric, that government closest to the people is the best government and small government and all those things. So when these things are inserted into the budget, like regulations for frac sand mining or other things, trying to take away control from the local people and then inserting this idea of private property rights, well, we live in communities, and like someone said, it's private property, but it's public water, and the same is true of all these issues. What a private landowner does when it, you know, does harm to the public good, to the public trust, I think that we have a right to regulate that, and you know, in the public interest. So, but I'm not surprised when, you know, the DNR secretary is a land developer, and the governor is you know, in the pocket of industry. So
we got you, Willem. We got you loud and clear. We are getting close to the top of the hour, though. I got to let you go, Mike Engelson. Last minute thoughts to what Willem was saying?
Well, I completely agree. I think the process is entirely undemocratic. Certainly, would have liked to have seen it. Have the public had a chance to really think through this whole change in process. I hope that in the future we'll have the ability to get some legislation like William was talking about earlier, that maybe will at least restore the ability of counties to go beyond the minimum standards.
All right, with that, we're out of time. Thank you so much, Mike Engelson, for joining us. Thank you also to Dave Klassen and George Meyer and the Outdoor Guys, Joe Knight and Dave Carlson. Also, big thanks to Team Westside, including Henry Lippold, Mort Cypress, Simone Foster, Kat Jacoby, Debbie Brown, and Dean Kallenbeck. Next week, we're going to preview a 24-hour study to count part of the region's homeless population. That's next Monday morning. Until then, have a safe and productive week. We'll chat again.